This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with New Yorker staff writer Dexter Filkins and Lou Lobello. On April 8, 2003, Lobello was serving in Iraq when he and his fellow Marines shot and killed members of a civilian family they mistook for the enemy. That day, the Marines were engaged in a firefight at a Baghdad intersection when three cars carrying the Khachaturian family made a wrong turn and drove toward them. The Marines yelled, trying to get the cars to stop, but it was difficult to hear anything over the roar of the gun battle. When the cars didn't respond, the Marines opened fire on them. Three of the family members were killed, a fourth was wounded. Years later, haunted by the memory of that day and dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, Lobello wanted to know what happened to the survivors. He turned to the Internet and found a New York Times story about the incident by Dexter Filkins. Lobello contacted Filkins, and together they located two survivors who were by then living in California and went to meet them. It's an incredible story, which Filkins writes about in his article Atonement, published in the October 29th edition of The New Yorker. Terry spoke with Dexter Filkins and Lou Lobello earlier this week.
Lou Lobello, I want to hear what happened from your perspective as a Marine at that intersection on that day. How did you realize that these three cars that you were shooting at were actually three cars carrying members of one extended family?
At that time, the reason that we found out that there were civilians is because the mom jumped out and waved a white flag. At that point, we ran out under fire to go rescue them. I don't think I found out that they were all members of the same family until about, 6 years after, maybe 5 years after, when I read Dexter's story that originally appeared in the New York Times.
So let's back up. Apparently the white flag that the woman was raising was a baby's T-shirt. The baby was in the car. And so when she was holding up the white flag and you realized it was civilians, it sounds like the Marines ran into the intersection to try to save the people in the car from the gun battle that was going on around them. You were one of the Marines who fired. Did you know if it was your bullet that killed anyone or wounded anyone? Could you tell if it was yours or not?
No, I don't think that any Marines could say that it was only them. I think that's the shared experience, is that everyone is firing at the same targets for the most part.
So you don't know for sure whether you killed somebody or not?
I don't think that there's a separation, Terry. It's not whether or not I killed someone or whether or not my buddy actually shot that person and that's why they died. It's a collective action.
So what was your reaction then? Was it as upsetting in the moment as it was in retrospect?
Well, at the moment, you don't have time to reflect and to think about the long-term consequences or the reality of what's going on. So at the time, it was just another day on the job. That's what Marines do. They engage the enemy, and they end up shooting innocent people. They end up shooting the enemy. They end up shooting anything that gets in their way. So at that time, it didn't affect me like it did years later.
Dexter Filkins, let me get to you. Back in 2003, right after this incident, you knew more of what had happened than Lou Lobello did. In other words, you knew more about what happened afterwards because you found out about this story when you were covering a hospital in Baghdad where you met one of the survivors from these three cars, a woman named Nora. And so just kind of set the scene for us about how you first found out about this story.
Well, it was an insane, crazy time. I mean, as anybody who was, watching television at the time would remember, it was a week after Saddam fell and his government fell, and Baghdad was just total chaos. There was looting everywhere. There was people being killed in the street. There were buildings on fire. I was just trying to make sense of whatever I could, and it was really hard because there was just so many different things going on, and so I was just driving around. Driving around trying to figure things out, and I saw this crazy scene in front of a hospital. were a crowd, and this was happening at all the hospitals. You know, there was a crowd of people trying to get inside so they could just tear everything apart and basically carry away anything of value. And I watched a doctor come out, you know, like a guy in a white lab coat with an automatic rifle and shoot it over the heads of the crowd to kind of scare them back. And, you know, what a scene. So I just pulled over and I went inside the hospital just to kind of see what I could see. And it was a scene inside the hospital, which was, you know, very much like the outside, total pandemonium. Most of the hospital had been looted. There was no electricity. The water was gone. There were people walking around carrying, you know, they're holding their bleeding limbs. It was extraordinary. And there was this woman who turned out to be Nora Khachaturian, a young woman, probably, I don't know, 21 years old at the time. Her mother and her aunt were standing over her in a hospital bed, and her shoulder had been, you know, really, really badly wounded. And so I just kind of sat down and talked to him about what had happened. And she, Nora, and her mom, Margaret, they kind of reconstructed this kind of event, you know, what had happened, you know, and how it came that she'd been shot in the shoulder and, you know, Nora's two brothers and her father had been killed just a couple days before. And so I somehow managed to find the Marines, you know, camped out in a field a couple of miles away. And I can't remember how I managed to get lucky like that, but I found them. And they were all very upset, and they kind of told me what happened from their perspective. And so I was kind of able to kind of piece together what had happened, this kind of terrible moment at this intersection. So I just wrote a story about it. I mean, that was, you know, which is what I do. And, you know, that was April 2003. And I wrote that story, and it kind of stayed with me because the Khachaturians were, they were very sweet people, and they were, you know, what had happened to them was terribly sad. And, you know, years went by. I spent almost 4 years in Baghdad, and I used to ask about them every, and I used to look around for them every now and then. And I saw a lot of death when I was there. But I never found them again, and I never heard from them again. And until, you know, a couple of months ago, I got a Facebook message from Lou out of the blue.
Lou Lobello, I want to get back to what this whole experience was like for you. You came home from Iraq, I think, not long after this incident. And it sounds from Dexter's article like it just started haunting you. And you had post-traumatic stress disorder. And it sounds as if this incident figured prominently into that. What were the things that you wanted to know? What were the things that went through your mind about what happened in that intersection when three people and a family were killed by the Marines who thought they were firing on enemy combatants?
Well, after April 8th, about 2 or 3 months later, I was home. And for the first 3 years that I was back home, I was still in the Marine Corps Reserves. So I was still training once a month. I was still meeting up with the Marines once a month. I didn't really start to suffer too many symptoms until I was eventually out of the Marines in 2007. During that time, I just, for some reason, started looking up anything I could of that day, just trying to find answers because it was the one day of our tour in Iraq that stuck out in every Marine's mind. At that point, I was already experiencing problems myself, and I was hearing stories of some of the Marines I served with getting in trouble with the law, getting divorces. One Marine killed his wife in Utah. And I couldn't help but think that, not just for myself, but for everyone, that we were carrying a lot from that day. And that's when I stumbled across Dexter's article.
Well, Dexter Filkins, what was your reaction when Lou Lobello contacted you?
I was just floored because I had just, you know, again, I was in Iraq for 4 years. I saw so many people die. And yet, I always remembered this family. I always, they just stuck in my mind. They're very, very sweet people. They're just the nicest. They're wonderful people. And I spent some time with them back then as I was kind of hearing their story, and it was so sad. And yet they were so gentle. And so as the years went by in Iraq, I used to, they lived in this neighborhood called Baladiat. And whenever I went to Baladiat, I would ask around after the Khachaturian family. I'd say, what happened to the Khachaturians? Where's this young woman named Nora? with blonde hair and the bad shoulder. And because I was sort of haunted by it, and you know, they sort of vanished. I think for the most part they were still there. I just was never able to find them. So I just thought it was going to be one of those things that I would, you know, one of those many you know, unfinished stories or kind of loose ends that I would just never hear the end of. And, you know, I have thousands of those. But so then to get Lou's message out of the blue was just weird. It was like this thing that this unconnected thing finally got connected again, you know, and then to discover, my God, that this family is living in an apartment in Glendale, California was just I just it's amazing for them to end up in this sunny little boulevard in Glendale is just extraordinary.
Well, one of the extraordinary things about it is that it was your article that helped them get out of Iraq to California. Do you want to explain that connection?
Yeah, I mean, God, there are just so many. You know, so this the Khachaturian family, basically, it's just the mom, Margaret. And they have, you know, you can see they have Christian names. They're Armenian Christians. They're Jehovah's Witnesses, of which there, you know, can't be more than a few in Baghdad. But they live together. Nora got married to a very nice man. And they lived there until 2006. And that was, you know, the worst part of the civil war in Iraq, when it was just, you know, unimaginably bad. And Assad, who is Nora's husband, was working for Reuters, for the news agency Reuters, and he got threatened by one of the pretty clearly by one of the death squads, basically saying, you know, you're working for the Westerners. If you keep doing it, we're going to kill you. So he took his family out of Iraq in 2006 and joined the, you know, then hundreds of thousands. I think there were more than 2 million Iraqi refugees in Syria. And they lived there for a few years trying to get out. And typically when you're a refugee in one of these situations, you basically go to UN, the High Commission for Refugees, UNHCR. It's a UN agency. And you sort of go there and throw yourself on them and say, can you find a country that will take me? You know, thousands and thousands of Iraqis did that. Tens of thousands of Iraqis did that. So they weren't getting anywhere. They were just, you know, their kind of application was languishing. And then at some point, the same relative whose house, I think it was like their Margaret's sister-in-law or something, the same relative whose house they were staying at in Baghdad had since moved to Canada, and she'd somehow seen my article and mailed it to them in wherever they were living in Damascus, Syria, in 2009. So in 2009, they took, you know, they like walked my article over there and sort of laid it down in front of the person at the UN and said, look, here's what happened to us. And they said, well, gosh, why didn't you tell us that, you know, your family had been killed by the Americans? And their application moved right away. And so by the end of 2009, I think they were in California. Miracle on miracle.
So Lulubello, before you actually met, you know, Margaret and Nora of the Khachaturian family, you contacted Nora through a video that you sent to her. Why was that the first way you wanted to make contact with her?
By sending a video, I felt that I could encapsulate more of the emotions I was feeling. I tried to write out something to send to them. I probably made 25 drafts and deleted them all. It just seemed so odd to put on paper. I just didn't know what to say, really. And every time I would read what I just wrote, I thought that it sounded like something I would hate to read if I was them. So eventually I tried to video myself in hopes that it would better show them the way I was feeling.
What did you say?
I introduced myself. I told them of the night that we met, and I told them I was sorry and that I had to speak to them if I could. I told them that they lived so close to me that I had to reach out. It was too odd to me to not want to say hello and not to find out how they were doing, to see if I could help them, really.
How close do they live?
About 2 hours.
That's close. And what was their reaction to actually meeting you?
Well, there's a big cultural difference, I would say, first off. I kind of expected to walk in and just embrace each other and cry, and they put me in my place very quickly and said, stop it, and don't cry, and sit down. And they're very, very composed when I first showed up. They looked like they could handle anything that came their way.
And so what was the conversation like after that?
It was heavy. It came in spurts. I was trying to explain what happened to them that day. They were offering their forgiveness. I would say every 5 minutes, it seemed like it would have been proper to stand up and say thank you and goodbye. And it took a lot to sit there through these long pauses and not run for the door.
Yeah, it was so, so intense. I mean, I just, you know, they live in this tiny apartment, and it was surreal. I mean, here we were, Lou and I, we were walking up to their house in this kind of palm-lined street in California to deal with this event that happened in Baghdad like almost 10 years ago, you know, in the middle of a war. And, you know, we walked up to their house, and I don't know, the kids were playing in the front yard, and it was pretty weird. But it was so intense. I think, if I may say, I mean, Lou's exactly right. I think that, you know, Lou kind of lost it right away, and they didn't. And at one point, Margaret said to Lou, you know, you're crying, but you know, I don't have any tears left. You know, all my tears are gone. And it was like that. You know, it was like that. And I think, you know, they were prepared, from what I could see. I mean, these are incredibly generous people. I mean, they have the biggest hearts in the world. They were prepared to forgive Lou and everyone. But they, you know, I think Margaret and Nora wanted Lou to know how much they'd suffered, too. They wanted to let him think about that a little bit.
Did you want their forgiveness? Were you seeking forgiveness?
I would like to think that I forgave myself and that I wasn't dependent on their forgiveness. But I've always prided myself on being able to say I'm sorry. That's the way I was brought up. If you do something that you're sorry about, you're not losing any face by saying I'm sorry, and you might be gaining a friend. So I think that more of us should say we're sorry.
So when they offered their forgiveness to you, how did they offer it? What did they say?
I believe Margaret said, we forgive you. Are you okay now that we've given you this forgiveness? You know, and I think that they tried to even tell themselves as though this was going to just wipe it away in some ways. You know, okay, Lou, you've come here now, and we forgive you. It was nice meeting you. I'll talk to you later. But I knew that I wanted more. I wanted to build a relationship with these people. I wanted to understand where they were coming from and help them out for their future.
So what did it mean to you when they actually offered their forgiveness?
It meant the world to me. I don't think it was a clear moment, though, where they said, we forgive you, and I suddenly felt better. The whole process of going up there, the whole journey to find the Cachadorians, and the whole experience was all part of it. Just letting me into their home and feeding me and meeting with me, the whole thing was as if they were saying, we forgive you and we understand.
All right, if I could just...
Yeah, Dexter.
It was unbearably tense in the beginning. We just, you know, it's a very small living room, and we sat there. There were five of the Cachadorians, the two kids, and then Lou and I and a photographer, who the photographer, by the way, Andrea Bruce, spent 7 years in Iraq. So it was a room full of very damaged people, but it was really, really tense. And just like as Lou said, there were just these long pauses, you know, and I don't, you know, I was sort of fumbling around and I don't know, taking cookies off the tray or something. But I think the moment that it all kind of gave way was, you know, she said, Margaret was looking right at Lou and said, yeah, I forgive you. Are you okay with that now? And then Lou, if I remember, Lou started to kind of break up a little bit, and he asked Assad for a cigarette.
Assad is Noor's husband.
Noor's husband, Iraqi. And they went outside. They went outside and shared a cigarette. And something changed when that happened. I don't know what you guys did out there, but everything just kind of, the tension broke. And then 10, 15 minutes passed, and then they came back inside, and kind of it was okay. Everything was okay after that. You know, the tension was sort of gone, and everybody sort of realized, you know, what was happening, and everybody was just a lot more comfortable.
Lou, what happened with that cigarette?
I think it was akin to two guys sharing a drink. I think it was just something that was universal, international. Having a cigarette, just, you know, talking about the weather and the kids, and it was just a mini bonding session. And I agree with Dexter. It felt a lot more loose after that. And Dexter and myself understand as well that the male of the house needs to be, I don't want to say appeased, but, you know, I felt as though Assad was my gatekeeper. And I think that having a couple minutes alone with him and the family seeing that me and him were able to talk and be comfortable with each other, it kind of set the tone for the rest.
Well, and then when Lou was outside with Assad smoking a cigarette and I was inside with the two Khachaturian women, Noora, who's now about 30, she'd been sitting quietly for the most part the whole time. And finally, when Lou was outside, she spoke and she said, we want to help him. And, you know, it was very nice. I mean, one of the oddities of the story, and there are so many, and I'm not really, I mean, I'm not sure what it means, but they're Christian, for one thing, which makes them a minority in Iraq. I mean, something like 2% of the population, are probably a lot less now because so many of them have left. And they're Jehovah's Witnesses, and they're very religious. So it was just, you know, every time I asked them about forgiving Lou or what had happened or how do they feel about it or why are they not bitter, because they're not, they would just default immediately to, you know, the Bible, or they would start talking about religion and God and forgiveness, and it was really amazing. I mean, you could just see the kind of the power of religion at a really, really micro level. I mean, they, you know, they believe deeply in their religion, and she said, and they said over and over again, we have to forgive him. You know, this is what, you know, God commands us to forgive. You know, he's forgiven us, and we have to forgive. We must. And there was no doubt in their mind about that. And the conviction with which they did it was very moving.
Lou, what has your relationship been like with the Khachaturian family since that first meeting when you confessed that you were one of the Marines who had shot at the family, killing three people, and they accepted your apology and forgave you?
Well, it's been very interesting. It's been very intense. I would actually say it's been spearheaded the most by Assad, who I probably talk to more than I do Noora or Margaret. And the other interesting thing about Assad is that he was at the hospital where Noora was taken after we fired upon her, and that's where they met. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dexter, but I think that's where they met,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally bizarre, this whole story.
Right.
I mean, you know, Assad, the husband, I mean, they ended up meeting. He met his future wife, Noora, in Al-Wasati Hospital, which is where I found Noora. But he was there because the Americans had fired accidentally, but they had fired and killed some journalists on a rooftop on the same day on the other side of town. These Reuters people, and he was working for Reuters, and some guys got wounded and some guys got killed. And so he took one of the wounded guys, who was British, to the hospital. And so he was basically in the next room. And so no, they brought Noora in one night, like after her surgery, and she was kind of crying and moaning and wailing from the pain. And again, this hospital was stripped of everything. There was no medicine. There was nothing. And the only way you could get anything, frankly, was by bribing somebody. And as Assad describes it, he said, I heard this, you know, this young woman, her cries, and I couldn't take it anymore. It was breaking my heart. So I grabbed a nurse and I gave her some money and I said, just find this woman some painkillers. And one thing led to another, and that's how they got married.
So, Lou, how many times have you seen the Khachaturian family since that first meeting? How often do you, communicate by email or whatever?
Well, about 2 weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, I was at a Glendale courtroom with them as one of their witnesses. So we have went in the last couple months from our initial meeting to a lot of communication through Facebook, which is a very easygoing platform. It's not as formal. I think that we really got to be comfortable with each other after the initial meeting. I went up there one night. I got a phone call from Assad, and he said that his neighbors were harassing them. So I woke up one of my law school buddies, Corey, and said, "You have to come to Glendale with me, and it's going to be a very odd trip, and I'll explain to you why in the car." And so I took my friend up there, and we sat with the Khachaturians and said, they're having problems with their neighbors. And I feel more than anything, they just wanted someone that they felt knew the system, knew American laws, understood what they should do. We ate that night. We had some more tea. After that, we talked on the phone multiple times. Long story short, I had to go up there, as I said, and visit the courthouse with them because they were unfamiliar with the process. So we spent about 4 hours in the pews together, and it was interesting. We've grown a lot closer, I would say.
So were they trying to sue the family that was harassing them?
Yeah, they were trying to get a restraining order against them, which is so interesting to me because those concepts for them when they were living in Iraq are foreign. To go now to the courthouse and to call the cops to help you, I don't think it's second nature to them. I thought that it was a really big leap of faith that they were going to try out the American system, and I was somewhat acting as their liaison, which was fun for me because, like I said, I'm in law school, so it was a good experience in that respect as well.
So for a long time, you were kind of haunted knowing that you were one of the Marines who fired on this family in an intersection in the early days of the Iraq War in 2003. Three of the family members were killed. You suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't know how much of that was based on this one day, on this one incident. But when you met the family and when you offered your apology and they offered their forgiveness, did something physically change for you? Did you sleep better? Did you feel less stress physically? Did anything, was there like a physiological change in your life?
No, I don't believe so.
Are you still experiencing PTSD?
Yes, very much so.
And this didn't change any of that?
It didn't change the symptoms that I have. I don't think it physiologically changed me. It helps the narrative story that plays through my head and gives me direction. And I think that perhaps in another 5 years that I will be able to say that I've had some real physical changes and that I'm not seeing the same symptoms. But as for now, it's just nothing but more exposure to these memories and these triggers. And I think that this kind of thing will pay dividends long down the road. But as for now, it's not as easy as this physiological change. So,
Lou Lobello and Dexter Filkin speaking with Terry Gross. Filkin's story about Lobello and his recent meeting with two surviving members of the Khachaturian family appears in the October 29th edition of The New Yorker. You could make the case that no figure in the history of rock and roll was more incongruous than Big Joe Turner. He was 6 feet tall, weighing in at 400 pounds, and in his 40s when stardom hit. Our rock historian Ed Ward says Turner was an improbable teen idol, responsible for a load of rock and roll hits.
Now when I get the blues, I get me a rocking chair. Get me a rocking chair. Well, the blues overtake me, gonna rock right away from here. Now when I get lonely,
Here's how it would work night after night in Kansas City. The band on stage would start a tune introduced by the piano player, Pete Johnson. After the first chorus, the bartender, a big guy just out of his teens, would start singing blues. He didn't really need a microphone, but he'd work his way to the one on stage anyway and carry on for a few more numbers. Then he'd walk back to the bar, pick up the bar towel, and continue pouring drinks for the customers. Joe Turner had been born in 1911 and went to work to support his mother when his father died in the early 1930s, but he'd already been sneaking into clubs and doing guest stints with the bands in places like the Backbiters Club, the Hole in the Wall, and the Cherry Blossom. His big break came when Pete Johnson, already a local favorite, gave him a regular gig at Piney Brown Sunset Cafe, and it was there in 1936 that John Hammond, in town to sign the Count Basie Band, heard the duo. He told jazz fans in New York about them, and soon they had a gig at the famous Door on 52nd Street. In 1938, Hammond included them in his famous Spirituals to Swing concert, and in so doing, ignited the boogie-woogie craze. The duo went into the studio to record one of their most popular numbers.
I've got a gal, lives up on that hill. I've got a gal, lives up on that hill. Well, they both try to quit me, Lord, but I love her still. She got eyes like diamonds, teeth shine like lime dyed gold. Got eyes like diamonds, teeth shine like lime dyed gold. Every time she loves me, you send my mellow soul.
Those verses, the girl up on the hill, the eyes shining like Klondike gold, and so on, would return in song after song, rolling, as he'd also say, like a big wheel in a Georgia cotton field. Joe, you see, was illiterate, but he also possessed a library of what blues scholars call floating verses that was second to none. And, of course, there was that voice. In April 1951, Joe had an unfortunate gig at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, singing with Count Basie's band as a last-minute substitute for Jimmy Rushing. The audience laughed as he missed cues, but among them was Ahmet Erdogan of Atlantic Records, who'd been trying to find Joe to sign him to his label, which was just emerging as a rhythm and blues powerhouse. He found Joe drowning his sorrows in Braddock's bar afterwards and offered him $500 for a session. They only recorded one number that time, but 2 years later, Joe tried again in New Orleans and recorded a smash.
I let her roll like a big wheel in a Georgia cotton field. Honey, hush. I didn't come in this house. Stop all that yakety yak. I didn't come in this house, baby. Stop all that yakety yak. Come fix my supper. Don't want no talking back. Well, you keep on jamming.
Honey, hush rocketed up the rhythm and blues charts and even saw some pop action, which was unusual in 1953. His next stop was Chicago in October, where, with Erdogan and his new business partner Jerry Wexler in charge of the session, they tapped a young guitarist who'd just moved north from Mississippi, Elmore James, to play on the session.
I was in my bed sleeping. Oh boy, what a dream.
But it was a 1954 session right at home in New York in Atlantic's offices, with the office furniture pushed against the walls to allow a hand-picked band of New York's best rhythm and blues musicians to set up, and Erdogan, Wexler, and the song's arranger, Jesse Stone, singing backup vocals and clapping their hands, where Joe, at the advanced age of 42, made rock and roll history.
Get out of that bed, wash your face and hands. Pots and pans. Well, you wear old dresses, the sun comes shining through. Well, you wear old dresses, the sun comes shining through. I can't believe mine, all of this belongs to you.
Shake, Rattle, and Roll was recorded by Bill Haley almost immediately, and Elvis Presley somewhat later, and, although they didn't use some of his more colorful verses, their picking the tune up ensured that it became one of the first rock and roll standards. Improbable as it seems, Big Joe Turner was a star, and he had star billing on the various rock and roll review tours he joined, and even appeared in a 1956 movie, Shake, Rattle, and Rock, where he split the music with Fats Domino. That was the same year that gave him his last big hit with an old blues standard.
Corrina, Corrina, where you been so long? Corrina, Corrina, where you been so long? I ain't had no lovin' since you've been gone. Corrina, 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 I love you so.
The backing group here is the Cookies, who'd soon join Ray Charles and become the Raelettes. Atlantic stuck with Big Joe for a couple more years, but eventually they parted company. He never stopped working, though, and died in California in 1985. I saw him performing in New York in the early 80s. He was living in the same apartment building as my friend Brian, and one day as we were headed back there, Big Joe was out front doing his daily exercises. Brian offered to introduce us, and as I shook Big Joe's big hand, I said, "It's an honor to meet you." He looked me straight in the eye and said, "Yes, it certainly is." I gotta say, it certainly was.
Ed Ward lives in France. Decades ago, our guest Tom Wolfe pioneered what became known as new journalism, using techniques of fiction, such as evocative scene descriptions and dialogue, to tell true stories. He used those storytelling methods in his books The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test and The Right Stuff. Wolfe turned to fiction in 1987 with the bestseller The Bonfire of the Vanities, a sprawling story of social relations and racial tension in New York City. His subsequent novels are A Man in Full and I Am Charlotte Simmons. Wolfe's latest novel, Back to Blood, is set in Miami and deals with racial and ethnic conflict among the city's diverse inhabitants, which include immigrants from Cuba, Haiti, and Russia, as well as the long-established African-American and Anglo communities. Its central character, a young Cuban-American police officer, struggles with his identity after a heroic act on the job makes him a traitor in the eyes of his own community. I spoke with Tom Wolfe earlier this week. Well, Tom Wolfe, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
When you wrote Bonfire of the Vanities, it was this remarkable picture of social currents in New York, and in your novel A Man in Full, you took us to Atlanta. This is about Miami. What drew you to South Florida?
I wanted to do a book on immigration. I was thinking of it even when I was doing my last book. At first, I was interested in the Vietnamese in California because they were spreading rapidly, at first around Los Angeles, and then one day I discovered they were up in San Jose, which is Northern California, to an extent that they were now publishing not only the San Jose Mercury, which is an old newspaper, but the Viet Mercury.
Wow.
And I said, hey, there must be a few people around here. But unfortunately, I couldn't speak the language, and it was just one group of immigrants. And then I heard about Florida. The first thing that caught my ear was that Miami is the only city, the only one I can find, in which people from a foreign country with a different language and a different culture have taken over a metropolitan area politically at the voting machine in slightly over one generation. Of course, that's the Cubans.
I want to ask you about the central character of this book is a young Cuban named Nestor Camacho. He is on the police force. You want to just give us a little profile of him?
Yeah. Nestor Camacho lives in Hialeah, in one of these little casitas with his parents and his grandparents. His older siblings have, by getting married, moved out of the house. And he is a young policeman. He was actually a pretty modest, conscientious policeman. He turned out to be pretty good, and he seemed to be pretty steady and tough, dangerous situations. But his horizon really was not much beyond being a good cop and marrying his girlfriend of 3 years named Magdalena, who was absolutely gorgeous. And this was his life, and he never realized that that kind of rather comfortable, conventional life could explode. Again, the police force was heavily Cuban, as he was second-generation Cuban, and he seemed to fit in perfectly.
Well, of course, he's a character in a Tom Wolfe novel, so what he doesn't know is he's going to get involved in some big events here. And there's this incident that sort of sets the plot in motion. Nestor is on the Marine Patrol Unit, and they get a call that this bedraggled Cuban refugee who's been dropped off by some boat has shimmied up the tall mast of a sailboat that's parked near a causeway, and he's at the top, at this bosun's chair atop this mast, pleading for someone in the causeway to help get him, because once he gets to dry land, he gets asylum, but if he's in the water, he can be sent back to Cuba. And then Nestor affects, and I won't give away all the details here, but, I mean, he affects a heroic rescue of this guy, which makes him a hero. He saves the guy's life, but it also makes him a traitor in the eyes of the Cuban community, because the guy's probably going to get sent back to Cuba because he didn't make land. It's a fascinating, it's a really gripping description, and I'll let people get the details from your book. But I'm wondering, what inspired that incident?
It's the entire dry foot, wet foot policies of the United States government. It's not Miami. This was all done in the wake of Castro and all the people who wanted to escape from Cuba and so on. And it was a great, if you will, public relations coup and also a rather humanitarian thing to allow as many in as, you know, could be accommodated. How exactly this dry foot, wet foot thing began, that point I don't know. But if you had reached land, and this is actually for any Cuban anywhere in America, if you had reached land, you could not be sent back to Cuba. You might be prosecuted for some vile crime that you had committed, but you couldn't be sent back. And if you touched anything that is connected to the United States, like a bridge, then you were considered a dry foot. But if you came in by water and you didn't make it all the way in, you could be sent back. Actually, these people who came in as wet foots or tried to come in would be questioned by the Coast Guard and given a chance to prove that they had left because they were in immediate danger.
One of the memorable descriptions in this book is of something called the Columbus Day Regatta, which I hadn't heard of, but is a real thing in Miami. And I know that you visited this. You want to just tell us a little bit about this, your visit to the Columbus Day Regatta?
Yeah. I'll tell this briefly as I can. The regatta is actually a sailboat race. It ends up at a rather barren little island called Elliott Key. It's about 60 miles south of Miami. When the regatta first began, after the race, all the crews and the owners and everything would get together and have a party. Well, these parties began to get wilder and wilder, and people on the mainland began hearing about these Columbus Day regatta parties. And so when I got there, there were easily more than 1,000 boats had congregated around Elliott Key. I mean, 1,000 boats is a massive lot of structures and humanity. And they were waiting for the evening. And the police, up until recently, didn't try to control things. People would lash together boats, 12 in a row, which created one gigantic deck. You had to go up and down on the deck. And it became wilder and wilder and wilder until finally they would be showing pornographic films on the sails of schooners. And they would, in essence, have orgies right there on the decks. I couldn't believe this.
You saw this personally?
So I saw it personally. As I say, it has cooled down a bit because there is a police presence now. But nevertheless, for example, I won't go too graphic detail, but the bare breasts begin about 5:30 p.m., and then we go on from there. It's absolutely extraordinary.
Do you think it says anything about Miami culture?
Well, it probably does. John Timoney, who was deputy commissioner of police in New York, then became chief of police in Philadelphia, and then became chief of police in Miami. So he knows the East Coast pretty well. He said to me, New York is the city of money. Washington, D.C. is the city of power. Miami is the city of sex. Now, I haven't checked out all the other places to see if that's really that's really true. But there is a little bit of hedonism in the air.
You know, in so many of your books, you write these wonderful descriptions of characters kind of struggling in changing times. You ever picture yourself writing a description of Tom Wolfe?
Actually, I do. And I think I would be I would write of him, Tom Wolfe, as this rather old-fashioned figure. All these damn white suits he has and all this stuff. And you ought to see his shoes. Oh, they look like spats. They're not spats, but that's the kind of thing you run into when you run into Tom Wolfe.
Tom Wolfe. His new novel is called Back to Blood. You'll find a longer version of our conversation, as well as an excerpt from Wolfe's new novel online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.